Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Cecilia Conrad, Managing Director at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And before moving to Chicago, I was a Californian. I was a professor of economics and vice president for academic affairs at Pomona College. I will be your moderator today. This program is part of a 35th anniversary celebration of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Fellows Program. Some of you may know it better as the Genius Grants. The Genius Grants recognize exceptionally creative people who inspire us all. Past MacArthur grantees include Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda, Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, choreographer Twyla Tharp, and World Wide Web inventor Tim Berners-Lee. The MacArthur Foundation is one of the country's largest independent foundations, and it has the guiding principle that truly significant progress can be made to solve the world's most pressing social challenges. Tonight, we have a twofer. We will first have a fascinating conversation with two MacArthur Fellows from the San Francisco Bay Area about creativity and problem solving. And then later, I will discuss MacArthur's new initiative, 100 and Change, a competition for a single $100 million grant to solve a critical problem of our time. But let me start with introducing our two speakers, technologist Manish Agrawala and digital artist Camille Utterback. Camille Utterback is an internationally acclaimed artist and pioneer in the field of digital and interactive art. Ms. Utterback's work explores the aesthetic and experiential possibilities of linking computational systems to human movement and physicality in visually layered ways. Ms. Utterback's work has been exhibited at galleries, festivals, and museums internationally, including the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York, the Seoul Korea Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Center for Contemporary Art in Kiev, Ukraine. Very international. Ms. Utterback is currently an assistant professor in the Art and Art History Department at Stanford University, where she also co-directs the Stanford Graduate Design Program. Manish Agrawala is a computer scientist designing visual interfaces that enhance our ability to understand large quantities of complex information. He is a professor of computer science and director of the Brown Institute for Media Innovation at Stanford University. He works on visualization, computer graphics, and human-computer interaction. His focus is on investigating how cognitive design principles can be used to improve the effectiveness of audiovisual media. The goals of this work are to discover the design principles and then instantiate them in both interactive and automated design tools. Please welcome our panelists. Now, one of the things about the Fellows Program is that you can't apply for the fellowship. And ideally, you don't even know that we're looking at you. So we get pretty good at digging deep into people's past and finding pieces of information that they would never guess we know. And so I'm going to start with one of the pieces of information for Manish is that I found an interview that was done with him by his high school newspaper. Or a newsletter. And in this interview, you describe your work as figuring out how images convey information and ideas to people. But you also seem to be interested in how people might use those tools to tell stories to each other. Can you tell us more about your work and the impact of the fellowship, if any, on what you've done?
Sure, yes. So, you know, the two things go hand in hand. I'm very interested in understanding how we communicate through visual imagery. And so, I'll give you an example. So think about driving directions, route maps. You can get them online. You've been able to get them online for some time now. If you go to a site like Google Maps, you can type in an origin and a destination, and you can see a map that will get you from the origin to the destination. And when you do that, the map that you get is usually a map that's drawn to scale. And because it's drawn to scale, you only really see the highways in the map, right? And so we can compare that to a hand-drawn map for the same route. If I asked you to draw me a map between two locations, it would look very different than the kind of map that you would get on Google Maps. It wouldn't be drawn to scale in particular, but it would contain all of the information required to get from the origin to the destination. And in particular, what it would contain is all of the turns that you have to make to go from the origin to the destination. So a hand-drawn map, in some ways, is a lot better than a map that's drawn to scale. I think the interesting thing about the way the map communicates is that it preserves the topology, all of the turns in the route, but distorts the geometry. It distorts it pretty significantly. One of the first things that we did was develop a system, a tool that could automatically take an origin and a destination and generate this nonlinearly scaled map that looks a lot like a hand-drawn map and shows you exactly the turns you need to make to get from the origin to the destination. We can apply this to lots and lots of different kinds of routes. We can, most often when you go to one of these mapping sites, you're getting a map that is, maybe from where you live to somewhere in the local region, but you might not know the region right around the destination. And so these maps that are distorted in this way can provide you with all of the information around the destination. Now, we can also run this for cross-country routes. And so we can produce this kind of distorted map to get all the way across the country. And here, you can see all of the detail at the start of the route, including the on-ramp from the local roads onto the highways. And then you see a long sequence of highways until you get to the destination, and there you get off the highways and, back onto the local roads. And all of that detail is visible in this kind of a map. And so here again, the important thing in these hand-drawn maps is the sequence of turns, and that's what you want to emphasize. And you see these kinds of maps for hand-drawn driving directions or route maps, but another place they turn up is with things like wedding maps. When you have a wedding, you invite people from all around the area to a small set of destinations. Usually there's the location where the ceremony is happening, maybe there's another location for the reception, and so on. You want to show all of the possible destinations, and because people are coming from all around the area, you also want to show multiple ways to get there. But the interesting thing in looking in hand-designed wedding maps is that they also are not drawn to scale. They provide a lot more detail right around those destinations. And so we've further gone and developed techniques for producing these distorted maps that show you all of the local roads around the destinations, but still preserve some of the additional scale or some of the additional roads at a larger scale, the highways from all around the region, so that everyone can get to the destinations. And so that's the kind of work that we've done in understanding how images convey information, we've also been interested in storytelling. And so we've developed tools with the goal of letting anyone just walk up and use the tools. Here, we've been looking at interfaces to create animations. And so one of the skills that, you know, all of us have from a very young age is to be able to draw characters on paper. And so we've built a tool where you can draw these characters on paper and cut them out, show them to a camera, and then the camera builds what's called a mat for the character. And as you move around the character on a table, the paper cutout on a table, in real time, the system is generating an animation of the content with your hands removed on a new background and so on. And so it's a really easy way for someone to come up and just start telling stories.
I've seen pictures somewhere where there were trucks, like we were Tonka trucks, and you could move those trucks around.
That
system.
Yeah, so this is the same kind of thing. Here you're telling stories with paper cutouts. There you're telling stories with toys. Yeah. So, So you can just, instead of using a regular web camera, you can start to use a Kinect or a 3D camera to track the motions as you're playing with toys, as a kid is maybe enacting a story, and then generate these kinds of animations from that enacted story.
That's pretty good. So, Camille, you also in some respect are engaged in kind of storytelling, and I dug into one of your old blogs.
Oh.
And you had a blog post entitled "Designing Systems for Human Interaction, Not Human-Computer Interaction." And I wonder if you talk about what the distinction is that you're making there and how that plays out in your work.
So I think that was sort of me trying to be provocative and against the sort of tech rah-rah, which we're certainly familiar with here. Obviously, technology is an amazing tool, but I don't think people are actually interested in interacting with computers per se. They are interested in interacting with each other, as we now know from this term social media, among other things, or telling stories, or getting to where they want to go. So I think when we put the computer as the kind of important word in this description, that maybe leads us to focus on something that isn't what I care about anyway as an artist. I certainly want to use tools, but I want to use them to help people be present and with each other in the ways that I think gives us the most joy in our lives. So if we look at my work over time, I first got excited about using technology as a tool to create these human interactions in a project called TechStrain, which was a collaboration with a fellow NYU student, Romy Ashitov. And we used a camera embedded in a projection screen that would reflect you on the screen, but you could interact with a set of letters that were falling, which were actually a poem. So by using your body, you could catch the letters along your arms or anything really that you brought into the space with you and eventually read the poem, perhaps, although it's a little hard. But we were really interested in how that completely changed people's interaction with each other. They would either cooperate or try to steal the letters from each other. So I think they would tell you, people that have experienced this installation, which is actually the piece that the Smithsonian collected recently, thanks to my gallery, Haynes Gallery, that they're having an experience with each other. Like, they're not having an experience with the computer, even though the computer is facilitating that interaction, which was a real revelation for me in terms of how you could use that tool. Computers are really helpful to create imagery as well, but then again, I think you're having an experience with that image, not the computer necessarily. I mean, it would be like saying, are we interacting with paintbrushes when we look at a painting? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's really what's happening. So from that piece, I did a lot of works that were kind of room scale of thinking about how people engage with each other in an inside space. And eventually got some opportunities to start doing projects outside at kind of architectural scale, also using computer vision. So in the same way that the camera was the interface for TechStrain, in a piece in 2007. So our texturing was from 1999, just for the record. So early kind of computer vision art projects. It's so exciting now that there's the technology has become easier to use. It was really hard to do at that time. It's still a little hard to do, but it's so exciting that there are more people working in this way now.
Of course, Anish is making it easier.
Yeah, even easier. So you don't have to write any code at all, which is excellent. So I started thinking about how could we use cameras in other ways to create other kinds of interactions. And in this case, which was a temporary project for the San Jose City Hall, I had a camera up on the dome of the City Hall looking at the whole plaza so I could track like a couple hundred people. And an interesting question then is like, what becomes interesting? It's less about seeing someone's hand that could create a really beautiful shape to collect letters, but more maybe how do groups form in that space? So the projection that was reacting to people, I was experimenting with things like a sort of color would grow when a group stayed together for longer, or when people walked in the projection on the architecture across certain architectural details that would activate other things. And if we talk about failure, there was a lot of ways that this piece failed. It was the first time I had done something at that scale. So maybe we can talk about that later. More recently, I've been really interested in how do you combine what digital technology and programming in particular and the camera interaction allows, which is this variability, with some of the sensuality and materiality of our analog world. So this project I did in 2013 called Flourish, which is at a corporate headquarters in Boston, I worked with Franz Meyer of Munich, who's a really historic glass fabricator, to create custom panels of glass that we mounted sort of 2.5 inches apart from each other. So there's two pieces of glass, each with a gap between them, and then I'm projecting onto those. And in the glass, there are opaque areas that can catch the projection on the different different layers as well as on the wall. So for me, this was solving a lot of problems I was thinking about as an artist. You know, how do you create work that uses a computer, uses programming for a commission where an organization or a museum wants it to last, right? Mm-hmm. As an artist, this was a few years ago, if you did a commission for the city of New York, you had to guarantee it would last 30 years. That was your responsibility as an artist. I think they may have changed that now, or at least in certain situations, but who has a computer that's 30 years old that's still working, right? Like, this is impossible. Someone raised their hand. We should talk. So I was thinking, you know, could I create a hybrid artwork that allows that component to be active now, but maybe when it's not feasible to maintain that, could it still have some existence? So this really beautiful custom glass with the colors and the opaque areas that can catch the projection as long as we choose to maintain that and then kind of become the history part of that was interesting. But more interesting to me in terms of the effect it has is it creates a projection with depth. So we're so good, our eyes, we've evolved to see texture. Like, you know, if you look at someone next to you, you can really see the texture of their hair or the material. That doesn't come through on our screens. So I was trying to figure out how to have that beauty and that our ability to see that along with a changing animation. So I hope that both of those elements are really captured in this piece, and working with glass is something that I'm going to continue to do. So like you'll see, I'll talk about a couple of new experiments with that. Projecting onto the glass also gives the illusion of the colored light combining with the colored glass, so you get a secondary color. Like if you projected blue onto a yellow area of glass, you'd actually get green. So I think there's something really magical that happens when you combine those things. Similarly, I've started to think about transparent screens, which is something... Oh, sorry. like OLED transparent screens are something that we are going to be seeing more and more. Unfortunately, one of the first uses I've heard described for this is to advertise to you on refrigerator doors in stores. So like you'll get your ad for which beverage you should choose as you're opening the door. But I've been thinking, so these screens would be full motion video, HD resolution. They're out there. They're starting, you'll be seeing them soon. But I was thinking, could that ability to look through the screen, similarly to the glass, give us a way to interact maybe more with each other. So I've created some proposals where we're using these transparent screens in a public setting. There would be video on them, and the interaction would be activated with people looking at each other through those screens. I'm hoping that that kind of, instead of screens in our public spaces taking us away from each other, even making us look, you know, not at each other, but somewhere else to get mm-hmm. that information or to see that video, that this could create another possibility. Another interesting thing is that when you shine light through these transparent screens, you have the shadow on the ground. So I think there's a possibility that that these could integrate into the environment more by thinking about how the shadows land on the ground. A piece I recently did at the Contemporary Jewish Museum here in San Francisco, I don't know if anyone saw that show, it was called New Experiments in Art and Technology, was combining this idea of looking at each other through a screen and the depth of the Flourish piece with the layers of glass. So this piece had three scrims with projections onto both sides, and both the imagery interacted on both sides. So if you're on one side of the screen, imagery on that side reacted to you. If you're on the other side, imagery on that side reacted to you, but they are combining in the scrim. So I got interested in the fact that we want our technology to always be at our beck and call. And in this situation, I created it, part of the imagery was under your control and part of it wasn't, because it was controlled by the other person. So what is this negotiated shared space between us again in our worlds? That was a fun experiment, and kind of going back to some of the interactive drawing systems that I'd done previously. And the most recent work I've been doing is kind of even more experiments using glass, which I mentioned. So I had the opportunity to be an artist in residence at Pilchuck Glass School last summer. I got to work with Dante Marioni, who's one of the best known glass blowers, American glass blowers, and his assistant, Mickey Koza. I got the chance just to ask them to blow glass for me. So we took lots of chips of translucent and transparent and different patterned glass and blew them into these kind of globules of glass. Dante really didn't like this because he's so precise that me wanting to just throw things into the glass made him really irritated. But Mikey would work with me. So they would come out with these multiple layers of glass in them, which then I would project into. So if you can imagine the different layers of glass and the depth of that blob of glass are each catching the light at different depths. And then when you create a different situation, putting them all on the table, you really get a sense of dimensionality, which we don't tend to think about in our projection. So I think this idea of a sort of sculptural scenario using projection is something that offers a really nice combination, again, of us being able to walk around and move in the space and not remove us from our, like this beautiful glass and the surroundings we're in, but also take advantage of using animation in different ways. So
we've got some interesting questions here that have come from the audience. And one of the things that strikes me as I listen to both of you is the emphasis on the human interaction and on conveying kind of information and experiences, getting people to interact with each other. One of the questions here is, how should we think about learning in that context, given the fact that there is so much information out there? It says accessible, but I really think they mean more than accessible, that there's just so much of it there. And another question related to that is, what are the best strategies for basically learning, for enhancing and preserving memory? Are any of the techniques you're working with techniques that might be used in the context of preserving memory and information in that form?
Can I take a step back even about like learning and what that really means? So part of why I got really captivated about using cameras in these computer vision systems that let the imagery react to people was it created a situation where they became the sort of explorer and they had to come up with the question, right? So there's no directions in my piece that say, stick out your arms and try to catch the letters in text rain, for example, but people walk into that space and they say, hey, something's happening. Why am I up on that screen? There's something else going on. What happens if I stick out my arm? Oh, I can catch the letters. You know, what happens if I turn the umbrella I have upside down? Can I catch them on the inside? Right. So they start trying to understand the bounds of the system that I've created, or in that case, Romy and I have created. And I think that's a really interesting, that's how kids kind of explore the world. They start making a hypothesis and testing it. Like, what happens if I turn this glass of water over? Like, do I get yelled at? Like, does the floor get wet? What's going on? So I think that kind of learning where we're actually coming up with the questions is, to me, what's exciting about these kind of systems we create.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really engaging to have these interactive systems where you can go and experiment and just try things out. We took our system for making animation by playing with toys to the Maker Faire, and we had lots and lots of kids come and just try to make animations using the system. And they found all kinds of bugs in our program. but they did that by just interacting with it and trying out various things. I think a few of them really wanted to break the program, and they were excited when they did that. And then we could, you know, think about why what they did broke the program, and talk with them about it. And that was really instructional to us, and I think to them as well.
And I think when you think about design of interactive systems, the ones that kind of force you into a certain way of doing things, like, oh, you're not doing that right, you have to stand over here, or you have to like stand on your head or do this other thing, like, we've all had that experience, like in the real world, when the door, you try to push it and you're supposed to pull it, right? That the design of the handle is so crappy that you can't even, it's not that you don't know how to use a door, it's that the door handle is stupid and badly designed. That's Don Norman, by the way, who first identified that very clearly for us as a culture, as a problem. And so I think those same design issues come up in interactive systems, like how, you know, there's a lot of computer vision interactive systems that are sort of what I would call a one-liner. Like, you can only do one thing and you have to do it in a certain way. And I don't think that encourages this sort of exploratory learning that teaches you how to do something really specific in the right way, right? Which we all know about that from our different education systems. There's some kinds of learning that you learn to master a certain trajectory, which certainly has its advantages, but there's other kind of learning that is about, I think, more creative question asking. And so in my systems, I've really struggled, or, you know, the exciting moment is when you hit that balance of like, it's, there's enough openness that people are constantly surprising you and coming up with new things to do, which hopefully don't break the system. And it retains that richness, right? If it's functioning, in my case, as a work of art, like, works of art are things we come back to over and over and over again. They don't just like, oh, I get it, great, next. You know, and I think that that's really the art of creating a system that is a piece of art, is that it's something you can keep going back to, and that richness is there. The interaction, there's enough happening that it keeps giving you a new experience, not in the kind of cheap new throw it out way, but there's, you keep discovering more that's happening in that moment.
So one of the things that I wondered about for both of you, you both bring in the human. I actually tried to invent a new phrase. We've talked a lot, you know, we've talked a lot about STEM, and now recently it's very popular to say STEAM, where you add the A in. But I think we actually need, and I was trying to create it, it's going to sound like it's Yiddish, shusteam, where I've added an H for the human component to it. And I wonder, particularly when I listen to you talk, Manish, about the maps and this sort of set of tools that you're working on, how did you get engaged with that? What was it that made you interested in this set of tools? Were you seeking to solve a particular problem? Are there practical applications of some of these tools that you're thinking about down the road?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I'm a computer scientist, but I work in human-computer interaction. And a lot of the work that we do ends up focusing on studying people rather than computers. So in the case of the maps, we really wanted to understand what makes a hand-drawn map so effective. And I got very interested in learning about the cognitive psychology of maps. And I had a fantastic mentor at Stanford, Barbara Tversky, who had done some of the foundational work on the way people think of maps, mental maps. She had done work where she asked subjects to come in and draw maps from one location to another. So she had a whole bunch of these hand-drawn maps, and she's the one who really recognized that the exact geometry of the roads doesn't matter. What really matters is the sequence of turns and executing those correctly. And so so there had been this work in cognitive psychology about mental maps, and we were then using that and building on that to develop our mapping system.
So is the thought that this could be useful in terms of science education or other sorts of ways in which people might put these tools to use? Well, is the idea that teachers might bring them in a classroom, or?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that the when we're trying to figure out how to communicate to other people, the first thing that we want to do is really understand the information that needs to be communicated. And so when you're talking about a science education in the classroom, I think the key thing is to first figure out, you know, what are the points that you want to communicate, and then you can design the visuals and the other ways of communicating to really get those points across. And so often in our projects, what we are doing is trying to understand what the important information is for a particular domain, and then designing the visuals to really emphasize that important information and often de-emphasize a lot of the extraneous information or the less important information.
Now, we've got a couple of questions here related to the fellowship, but before we do that, I want to give a reminder for the radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are discussing creative problem solving with two awardees of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Fellowships, the so-called Genius Grants. Camille Utterback is an internationally renowned digital artist, and Manish Agrawala is an acclaimed computer scientist, and I'm Cecilia Conrad, Managing Director of the MacArthur Foundation and your moderator. So, talking about the fellowship for a moment, one person has asked, were you surprised when you got the call? So say a little bit about your experience when you got the call.
Well, so I was completely surprised. I was at home. It was early in the morning, and I had been working quite hard on submitting some work for a publication deadline, and so I got this call, and I was really focused. And usually when someone calls on the landline, it's a telemarketer of some sort. So I picked up the phone and I said hello, and I was a little bit curt with the person. I think it was Dan at the time. He basically said, hello, I'm Dan Sokolow from the MacArthur Foundation, and do you know what the MacArthur Award is? And I had kind of heard of these things, and I think I've heard of it, and I figured that he was going to ask me to recommend someone, so I was ready for the conversation to head in that direction, and it ended up heading in a different direction. And it was very, very surprising.
Yeah. I didn't return the call for like 3 days, and Dan was going crazy because I was like, I thought it was someone that wanted to ask. The original message they left was like, you know, this is Dan from the MacArthur Foundation. We need to talk to you about someone. And so I was like, oh God, like I have to like, you know, write another recommendation, which I love doing, but I'm really busy right now. And I was away for the weekend with my boyfriend, now my husband. And I like didn't want to return the call. And And I think they left another message, you know, over the weekend. I'm like, that's kind of pushy to call someone over the weekend. Like, I'm not calling them back. And finally, they called me at like 6:30 a.m. Monday morning, or maybe it was even Tuesday morning by that point. And I finally answered the phone. And I was completely shocked. Again, I thought I still, even in that conversation, assumed it was about somebody else or something else.
I called someone, I think, about 12 or 13 times on their cell phone, and they were out of the country and had the cell phone off. So they landed and they saw 13 calls. And they, who is this crazy person? Now, there are also a couple of questions that are just interested in kind of getting a little more inside of your heads and how you think. If you were to teach someone how to approach a problem or opportunity the way that you do, where would you start? And what habits have you cultivated to keep your thinking fresh?
I've been thinking about that a lot, actually, starting to become a full-time professor at Stanford, especially teaching art. I attended some really interesting teaching seminars from the Center for Teaching and Learning there, which illustrated a problem for me, which is that when you become an expert in your field, so much of your knowledge is implicit that you get sometimes frustrated teaching beginners again because it's really, like, it doesn't make sense to you why they're not putting A and B together, even after I've given a great lecture on really interesting artists using light in sculptural ways, and then the assignment is about using light in a sculptural way, and they're like, we don't understand this assignment. And it's like, oh, you know, how do you get back in that beginner's mind to help people start making that sparking that I think happens really easily? I've been thinking about kind of where that comes from. But for me, this kind of constantly asking questions or playfully putting things together is something that it's like it's so internal now, it's hard to weed back out. How did you start that process? I mean, I don't know when you're thinking up ideas, how that works for you.
Yeah, you know, for me, a lot of it is reading very widely and trying to understand work in other domains. But another thing that relates to what you were saying, Camille, is I was very lucky. A few years ago, I spent 6 months in New York working in journalism in an area that I have no background in, and just trying to be a beginner again and understand how some of the folks over at WNYC, the public radio affiliate in New York, how they put together the programs that they put together. It was just great to be back at that beginner level. You learn so much when you know nothing. and I found that to be really, really great for getting me just thinking about a different set of problems.
I think being comfortable in that discomfort. So I think in my work, I'm always trying to like approach using a different medium, or when I work in projects that use historical imagery, I'm going into a new archive about something I don't know about. Like the project I did here for the anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge was going into the Berkeley map archive and pulling through those maps. And when you enter a domain that you don't know anything about, to me, that's so exciting. And I think sometimes for students, they feel like, oh, maybe I'm going to do this wrong. Or especially Stanford students, they like to get A's, right? And so they're that discomfort of like, I don't know, instead of being joyful and like so exhilarating. If you're not in that mindset of confidence, like, oh, I'm going to figure this out. It's going to be hard, but I'll get there, can be, you know, can shut you down instead of open up new possibilities. So as a teacher, I'm trying to think about, like, how do I help students get to that place where what you don't know is fun, not a problem?
So I'm kind of going through here thinking about some of the questions, but there are a couple here that are back to the grant again. And I've talked about the fact that you can't apply for the MacArthur Fellowship. We secretly research you. We're looking for exceptionally creative individuals who show the potential for more creativity if they are given the resources to do so. And so one of the other kind of distinguishing features of the fellowship is that there's no strings attached. And so we are sometimes asked about that. That's sometimes questioned, like, why aren't we imposing strings Why aren't we making you do something?
We don't even have to report what we did with it at all.
So I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about what the impact of that has been on you and your work. And does it reshape your work in some way? One of the questions is, what is the end result of this? Why you?
Well, I can answer for I can't say why me, but for me, it allowed me to go and spend 6 months in New York working on something that, you know, I knew absolutely nothing about. And the no strings attached, I think, is fantastic because you stop having to worry about pleasing anyone with the work that you do, and you can really just focus on what you're interested in and pursuing that. And I found that to be really, really powerful. And then the other thing that it does do is that it can open certain doors.
For sure. I mean, for me, it came at a time where I was really struggling as an artist. Like, I had gotten to a certain point in my career, but my personal life was in a difficult situation, just getting divorced. And I was really trying to figure out, how was I going to make this career keep working? Like, I was getting to a certain age, or I was like, it's kind of embarrassing that it's hard to pay my rent. You know, like, what is this life? Like, how is it sustainable? And I think, you know, still in our culture, it's so hard to be an artist. You're just like working out that sustainability question all the time. And so to all of a sudden be handed this, like, for me, many, many years, that money to me was like, this is more than 5 years of ability to sustain my life. That to have that relief was just incredible. And I was even questioning, like, maybe I should stop trying to be an artist, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe this isn't going to work. Like, I, you know, and I had come to that at other places in my life. Like, when I started learning about technology, that was also like, I want to be engaged in our culture. I don't want to feel marginalized. And so how do I use my creativity in the situation I'm in to be effective, if that makes sense? And so I was like, maybe this isn't the most effective thing to be doing right now to both sustain myself and be engaged culturally. And so that recognition of the fellowship was like, no, you should keep doing what you're doing, or, you know, innovating in what you're doing, but like, you're on the right path, like, don't give up now. So for me, that was really huge. And I think what Manish was saying, the recognition, I mean, now I have a stable faculty job, which has such an interesting set of other questions to deal with as a teacher, but I love being part of a bigger community. I'm in an academic community as well.
So one of the things, so you've identified the money, and we found when we did a review of the Fellows program a few years ago that the Fellows do like the money. you've talked about the credibility that the fellowship can convey. One of the other things is that people talk about the fact that it can elevate the field that the person is working in, because people suddenly pay attention to the fact that there is a field out there where people are trying to develop tools to interact with computers and so on. But the other thing that came out is that the fellowship has an impact on people other than the fellows. That when people hear about the announcement of the fellows and hear what the people are doing, that it has an inspiring impact on those who hear about it, that they think, I want to think some more about how I might take some risk, because you have taken risk, and you mentioned failure earlier. We should come back to that. And also that it inspires people to think about how they may contribute more to society. So I have, I guess, two questions about that. One is about risk-taking, and how important has that been for you, and what have been some of the failures along the way? And then another question about inspiration, sources of inspiration.
I was thinking about how do you learn how to fail in your life gracefully? Who teaches you that? How do you teach that to people as a teacher or a parent or something? And I'm going to give my mom credit. I was thinking about really specific examples, like, where do you learn that? Because I think, again, what I was trying to talk about with students, it's like that ability to fail over and over and not get depressed or be in a new situation over and over again is how hopefully you get to a place that isn't obvious, right? If it's obvious, you don't have to fail to get there. If it's not obvious, you have to fail a lot to get there, I think. And my mom, as soon as I had illustrated I wasn't going to cut off my finger or blow up the house in the kitchen, she let me do whatever I wanted in the kitchen. Like, seriously, like I would be putting together I don't know what to try to make a cake. I think before I could really read, like I was not following any recipe on how to make these potential cakes that often didn't even come out anywhere close to a cake, but like I knew you kind of needed an egg and some flour, and I mean, it was a disgusting mess, but she just let me keep trying to make cakes or do something. I mean, never became a good baker, but
it sounds like what you describe with people interacting with your art, right? They're just trying things.
Process. So, and she would never come in and say, that's disgusting. Or she would try it. And I think not even make a face. She would ask me, what was this cake? You know, what are you making here? So I think that trust of someone that like not to criticize that it was supposed to come out a certain way or it was supposed to even taste good or even look like a cake or anything, you know, and I think she instilled that, my dad too, in a lot of ways that if you are exploring something and learning something in that process, that was success. Like the end result, the cake wasn't the success. It was that you were learning something in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that I owe them a huge gratitude for helping me feel that or know that as a person. So, and we did talk about trust in terms of the MacArthur Fellowship. I think the trust that you give to the fellows by saying, you know what you most need to do with this money. Like, we can't tell you what that is that same kind of trust of like, you are in control of your own process. And we're not going to make you report back the cake either, what you made with it, you know, like come up with what's most interesting for you in the situation.
Some people tell us that the fact that there isn't any reporting required and that we say go off and do what you think is best is actually a bigger burden than having a report due at the end of the grant. And a lot of times I get reports even though I never asked for them. They just show up in the mail.
For the record, I didn't feel that.
What about you in risk-taking?
Yeah, so, well, that's interesting because there is sometimes a concern that I have that, you know, maybe I'm not doing the most that I could with this recognition and with the money, right? And so I think that kind of pressure can be used in a positive way to really make sure that you're using the resources that you have to the best of your abilities. And I think, you know, I think we strive to do that. That's really a positive thing in most cases.
So one of the person asked, what do you hope will be your legacy, your lasting impact?
Wow, am I going first? Okay. I'll take that on. I am really concerned about our physical relationships with our material world around us and our relationships with each other and how the tools we're designing either are deleterious to that or enhance that. And I feel like as an artist, I have leeway that I wouldn't have if I worked at a corporation like Google or Facebook. You know, they have a different set of constraints on them. And so I take that on as an artist by showing possibilities. Like, what could we be doing as a culture that's different than some of the things we are doing? And hopefully that pushes everything, including like our practical tools and the other things we need to make as a culture into a more, for lack of a better word, beautiful space. Like that our world becomes more sensual and engaging, not sort of isolating and grim, right? And I see both of those as very real possibilities. But I feel like as an artist, if my work is out there and people, it opens like another experience we could have, and someone else making more practical things thinks about that too, that maybe our whole culture shifts in a much more positive direction.
It's, I think one of the important things there is the value on beauty. I mean, there's a way in which we when we talk about creativity in the context of the fellowship, we're really conscious, because we look at creativity across all domains, we're really conscious of the fact that what creating something might be creating a new product or a new tool, but creating something can also just be creating objects of beauty that generate some kind of experience that we have that last for a long time as part of that.
Or creating new ideas.
Or creating new ideas. Yeah. And the idea of this, you know, I think is that these are things that are beneficial. So it's one of the reasons why we don't like genius very much. Genius can be evil. Right? Creativity is supposed to be creating good things. What about you?
Yeah, so for me, I think one of the things that I'm very interested in is developing technology while constantly focusing on the humans that are using it. So when we're studying visual communication, we're thinking a lot about the people and what information is important to the people, as we've talked about. When we're developing new interfaces, we're really thinking about the people that are going to be using those interfaces. And I think if we can just focus new technologies on the people that are involved, I think those technologies will be more effective and better for everyone.
I think it's interesting too, Manish, though, like, you're looking into the history of cartography. Like, you're also looking at the history of human culture and how we've already developed interesting tools. And I think sometimes our tech industries are really ahistorical. They think they're inventing something for the first time, or this has got to be the best way to do it, without looking at that deeper history and what we already have. And how can we build on that? It's not like disjunctive. It seems sometimes that our technological tools are disjunctive from these quote-unquote analog things. But if we look at that as a continuum, it's a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that historical context is incredibly important. And, you know, just thinking about why certain things have worked, even if they're older things, can lead to all kinds of new technologies.
So you both have a kind of, I'd call a rosy view about the way technology, we can use technology to have people interact better with each other, to learn, to do these things. And yet there's also kind of a grim view that robots will replace us all, that we won't have jobs, we won't interact with each other, we'll be sort of, I don't know, dismal. I wonder if you talk about that kind of view of the future.
I think there's real concerns about that. I mean, I get questions a lot because I'm using cameras, which are often used for surveillance. And I think now camera surveillance almost seems quaint compared to the other kinds of surveillance of our personal information. So clearly those are very real issues to be debating publicly. But I guess in my work, I think you make the best work when you come from kind of who you are, and I tend to be an optimist. So I'm looking at how do you show the positive, right? Like, how can we use this in a way that isn't being considered again? Like, can these transparent screens really be integrated with the light in our environments and give us a much more pleasurable, on our eyes and in our bodies, way of engaging with that technology rather than a critique? And I think there are amazing artists who are creating very profound critiques of the technology as well. So I think you play to your, like, who you are as a person. Yeah.
I'm not so concerned about robots taking over everything. And the reason for that is that when we're designing new products, new technologies, again, we're designing them for people. If robots take that over, they need to really understand people. And there's a lot that we generally don't understand about people. And so, for a robot to magically have that understanding, I think we're a little ways off from that.
There's going to be some pretty funny screw-ups, or hopefully not too tragic screw-ups in the meantime.
So related to this, then, is this question of whether positive social change is linear, Or are there unique windows in history when very big change is possible? And are we, I'll add, are we in one of those moments?
It's hard to know if, if we're in the middle of the moment, right? In hindsight,
it's it might be
easier to tell. Things do seem to be, you know, moving faster at some exponential rate, but again, it's harder to really tell when you're currently living it.
I feel like there are times when standards get put in place that are really important. Like, do we fight, you know, for our rights of privacy? And once those are gone, like, it's really hard to backtrack on certain things. So I think there are junctures where when we're setting a technological platform, you know, like the three prongs in our electric outlets or something like that, like that wasn't a done deal. You know, Edison and everyone fought really hard over DC versus AC. Like, I think there's those moments where we set an infrastructure in place. Like, it's really hard to get rid of our highways now, right? Like, we went that way because of the car industry instead of keeping our public transit. It's really hard to reverse that infrastructure once we get things in place. But within that, then there's a lot of interesting things that happen.
So are there things that are embedded in any of the technologies you're working with that we should be thinking about policies now, standards or rules about how they can be used or not used?
I mean, that's not my area of expertise so much. I talk about it with my students in terms of computer vision systems. So in some of the early camera tracking work I was doing, there weren't libraries that you could access as a coder to get information about, like, where is someone's hand? Are they pointing? Are they pinching? You know, which is really amazing research. The people that have come up with these libraries that let you extract that information are like, where is the skeleton? I had to kind of figure out what information I needed myself. So the disadvantage was it was hard. The advantage was I was really thinking about, like, how was I encoding movement and even what a person is. So I've said this before in classes, but, you know, if you use a skeleton tracking and some of these computer vision systems and you don't have an arm, you don't count, actually, because you don't have four limbs. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you don't have four limbs, so you're not the definition of a person. That's a real problem, right? I mean, I don't know if the computer vision systems are being used in ways where that discrimination is really actively happening right now, but there's a potential, right? So whatever the algorithm is that's defining who a human is in a computer vision system, there's parallels in a lot of our systems, right? About, you know, how are we being advertised to the thing that came out about, you know, women were not getting ads for CEO positions because of the algorithm that was deciding what you might be interested in. So our biases and our blindnesses get built into these things, but I'm not working on standards so much in my work. So I can have that conversation, but it's not part of what I'm doing to put platforms in place. Like, I'm not building those libraries.
But you're creating public art where you may have people interacting. And so there's the question of, can people have experiences of that art despite differences in what their natures are or their
physical and what their shapes are. Me, reacting to, like, our blobbiness and thinness or fatness or curly hair, you know, like, what I try to react to is a broader sense of how, you know, who is standing in front of that camera, even just in a simple visual sense. Your outline is really different than your skeleton,
right,
in terms of what we know about someone because of that or how we feel our humanity in that. So I hope by teaching students to question that, or do they want to build their own system, or go, what's the advantage of using a platform, an infrastructure that's developed, and what's the advantage of building your own, I think those are important things to teach people about this, all the technology that's we're using.
Completely agree. You know, I think there can be lots of inadvertent consequences of technology, and so you always have to keep an eye and make sure that something that you didn't account for isn't happening.
So there have been a couple of questions about 100 and change. And so I think I'll take a moment now to talk about that. But first, I'll show you, and people on the radio can hear, a very short video that describes 100 and change in this initiative.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. of the challenges that confront us, both new and age old, there are peaks that seem insurmountable. Someday, maybe. But we believe there are mountains you can climb today, and big problems you can solve across all fields of endeavor with ingenuity, tenacity, and the resources to turn promising progress into a true solution. The MacArthur Foundation is launching a new competition, 100 and Change, to award a $100 million grant to solve an important problem. You must both describe the problem and offer a solution that creates meaningful and durable change. No issue or field is out of bounds. The only limit? Your track record, your creativity, and your imagination. 100 and Change. Are you ready to solve a problem?
So the idea behind 100 and Change is that we're going to be making a single grant of $100 million to solve a problem, take a big slice of a problem, or to unlock the resources required to solve a problem. What makes this unusual is that we are not defining what the problem is or the nature of the solution, and that the competition is open to both for-profit and nonprofit organizations from anywhere in the globe. Now, designing a program like this has a big challenge, and that is that we're going to be getting in all sorts of proposals from very different arenas. And someone asked a question, and I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on this. We've designed a rubric that our judges will use that we think is agnostic across domains. It's meaningful, that it has to be a problem that we think is important and compelling, verifiable, that there is evidence that your solution will work, feasible, you can actually implement this solution, and both in terms of we're looking at social, political obstacles, but also whether your team has the capacity to do it. And then finally, durable, because we want the solution to last. So the question someone has posed is, how do we distinguish between broad and shallow impact on many, many people versus deep and intense impact on fewer people? Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's an excellent question. It's only one. You should have done two, and then you could give one to the broad and one to the...
Well, you know, in fact, the program is designed that once we've gotten through this first round of the competition, we're going to narrow it to up to 10 semifinalists, and we'll be working with those 10 semifinalists, and I'm imagining they're going to have a mix to help develop fully their scalability plans, their implementation plans. We'll then narrow it to 5, but for the 10 and the 5, we are planning to engage other funders. And my fantasy is that when we get down to the last 5 and they're going to make a public presentation of their work, that we'll actually have a fight over who gets to fund what. So, but that may be one way of doing it, is actually trying to find some funding for more than one idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think both of those have huge value. Especially without knowing the specific projects, that to me would depend.
Yeah, it must be very hard to compare. You know, how do you go about judging the projects that are going to come in? Is there?
We have impaneled a group of judges that are people that we think are really smart and wise, and also capable of giving constructive criticism. Because all of the valid applications will get feedback from the judges, so there's some return, even if you don't make it past the first round. But they are being asked to evaluate the proposals on those 4 criteria. We're relying a bit on their good judgment. There are some fellows among them, but there are also many other people from many other sectors. I have defied people to go to the website, which is 100andchange.org, and look at the judges and see if you can figure out any bias towards what kind of problem we want. And if you think you figured out one, send me a note so I'll try and fix it.
I have a question, actually. Yes. I know we don't have much more time, But to me, the idea that you have to prove the problem is solvable does bias towards problems we think are solvable.
That's true. And there is a notion here that we're not necessarily like some of the grand challenges where there's some problem out there that no one has a solution to. And so we put out, if you can solve this, then you'll get this prize. Where our theory is that people have tested things and that they've gotten funding from foundations to test things. But after they were tested and everybody found out they worked, everybody went, oh, that's old. I don't want to fund that anymore. So we'd go on a shelf and sit. So we're hoping that there's some things on the shelf that people know that they can do, but for want of a concentrated amount of resources. So, I mean, that's really the kind of niche we've defined for 100 and change overall. So we have one last question in our last minute here. And this is a question that someone had a quote. It says, life is too short to have to prove you're human. Comedian David Feldman show. Please discuss.
Turing test?
I don't think you should have to prove it.
Maybe?
Well, you know, there's a lot of science fiction where as we start engaging more and more with these systems, one does wonder, am I talking to a human or a computer or what's going on? So I think Sherry Turkle's an interesting writer who's written about how we constantly redefine what it is to be human. So before, like cars and trains and things that could locomote, well, humans and animals, sentient beings, were ones that could locomote on their own, like a machine couldn't do that. And then when they started being able to move on their own, we were the ones who could think. Then when we had like computational machines, we're the ones who can feel, right? So that boundary is sort of negotiable, I think, and probably will continue to be so, which is an important project to define what we think it is to be human.
And on that note, please thank our panelists. And as a reminder to the radio audience, you've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, where we have had a conversation with two MacArthur Fellows, Camille Utterback, an internationally renowned digital artist, and Manish Agrawala, an acclaimed computer scientist. I'm Cecilia Conrad, Managing Director of the MacArthur Foundation. How come I keep messing that up? And your moderator, and this meeting of the Commonwealth is closed.